This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Doubt podcast. My name is Rob Rosen. I am the executive producer and creator of the TV show Reasonable Doubt.
And my name is Detective Chris Anderson. I'm a former homicide investigator and co-host of Reasonable Doubt.
And my name is Fatima Silva. I'm a criminal defense attorney and co-host of Reasonable Doubt.
All right. So Reasonable Doubt, the television show, runs every Tuesday night on Discovery ID at 10 o'clock. Please make sure to watch it. If you haven't watched some of our earlier episodes, please check those out on demand. And basically the premise is every episode, Fatima and Chris are called in by someone who has a loved one who's been convicted of murder. And they are absolutely convinced that their loved one was wrongfully convicted. And they give Chris and Fatima certain leads that they think will prove it. Chris and Fatima investigate those leads. And at the end of the show, they come back and either decide that it's a case they want to get behind, that they want to support, or they want the family to face some tough truths.
I was just laughing because that was a big lead-in. Like, you just right, like you were pitching our show to somebody like who's never watched it before. I hope people who are listening to the podcast have seen our show. There's no reason not to now, people. Okay, you're all home. Stay home, watch Reasonable Doubt, listen to our podcast. It's that easy.
How's your social distancing going, by the way?
Well, I have this little bratty one-year-old who just won't stay 6 feet away from me, unfortunately. So I'm quarantined with him.
Yeah. Chris, how are you doing with it?
So, yeah, social distancing is very easy for me because my kids don't like me. No, I'm joking.
Your kids are moved out, right?
CJ is still here.
But, CJ's still home.
Yeah, but my daughters, they were practicing social distancing before the government required it until it's time to pay rent and a mortgage.
I wish my kid was aware of what's happening. He's just excited. Mommy and daddy are home.
Fatima, let me tell you this, and you're going to remember this. Look, in 15 years, maybe even 16 years, you know, you're going to miss this. You're going to miss that bratty little one-year-old who doesn't practice.
You can remind me then, because right now I'm stuck in the house with him. And if I keep telling my husband, man, if this quarantine happened years ago, I would be living it up. I mean, I was meant for quarantine life. I just want to sit and read and watch all Netflix and everything on TV. But no, instead, I'm trying to shush him so he's not in the background of all Justin's phone calls. You know, he's going crazy in the house. We're in San Francisco. We don't have backyards.
I think I've learned that I hate quarantine life. Like, I always think that I'm an introverted extrovert, but I actually realized that, like, I have called so many people that I haven't talked to in, like, years and years, like, ex-girlfriends, and I'm like, Hey, I'm just checking in on you. How you doing?
Stop. So, Rob, I do have a question for you. How are you adjusting to this? Because Fatima and I both know how often you are gone, how hard you work as a producer.
On the road.
So how are you adjusting to social distancing?
Not well. Well, here's the one thing that I do. I live by the beach here in Southern California. I probably walk 10 to 12 miles a day. I'm actually I have been trying to lose weight for 2 years. I've tried every stupid diet, as you guys know. None of it worked. But what works is quarantining. Because,
really?
Yeah, because I'm not going out for dinner every night, which I almost always do. And I'm walking 2 or 3 hours listening to podcasts, the Reasonable Doubt podcast. And I'm just walking. And I've lost 5 pounds.
You've lost?
So, yeah.
I keep eating all the food we're stocking up.
Right. My quarantine snacks are gone. They are gone.
Have you heard about the, there's that new phrase, the Corona 19.
And the 19
We're gaining
pounds?
19 pounds.
That's
yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah. And that glass of wine every night that I normally never did. But now
is it just 19? Is that a limit? Is that just
I guess it depends how long this goes. Maybe it's optimistic for some people.
Okay.
That's it. I'm just going to get pregnant and blame it on baby weight, guys. Or make you all think I'm pregnant, but really I just ate all the food in the house.
All right. If you're listening to us for the first time, I promise you, we really do get to a case here. So in this case, it was
Horneck.
Yes, Warren Horneck. And it was a really unusual case. And before we get to it, let's just start with a little bit of background.
March 14th, 1995, Fort Worth, Texas. Former police officer Warren Horneck and his wife Bonnie are out drinking. 11 p.m., the two leave the bar. Both are intoxicated, but still make the five-minute drive home. 11:39 p.m., a frantic Warren calls 911.
Warren, 911. My wife has shot herself. Get over here now.
Bonnie is dead. The victim of a gunshot to the chest. A .38 special is by her side. Initially, it's considered a suicide, but 1 year later, Warren Horneck is charged with murder.
1996, Horneck stands trial for the murder of his wife. Prosecutors argue that he had a pattern of abusive behavior, but the case comes down to Warren's bloody shirt the night of the murder. The state argues the blood came from blowback when he shot his wife. The defense argues it came from CPR when he was trying to save her. The state wins. Warren is sentenced to 30 years in prison. He is scheduled to be released in 2026.
The first thing that I think hit everybody in this investigation is that usually it is a family member, a wife or a mother or a daughter who is calling us in. In this case, it was a friend. And the second guy, Bob, really barely knew him at all, but he did believe in the case. How did you guys react to that?
You know, for me, it was somewhat uncomfortable. You have a former police officer whose old car buddy is the one that's fighting for him. And then a guy that, you know, really didn't know him at all. So, you know, and it's not that I don't, it was just uncomfortable for me. I'll leave it at that.
I mean, obviously it didn't change how we go about our investigation, right?
Absolutely.
Into this regardless, and we always want to see if we can help out somebody who's been wrongfully convicted. But I guess it was strange because, you know, normally you can't help but wonder, well, why don't you have family here advocating for you? I mean, no one. We've had all kinds of loved ones advocate for their family members. We've had nieces, nephews, grandparents, I mean, cousins. So to have no one who can get on board, that was strange. It makes you wonder, well, how many bridges has this man burned?
People make the convicts out to be kind of saintly. And in this case, that wasn't the case at all. I mean, Jeff, who knew him pretty well, was pretty forthright about what kind of guy he was.
What I've not heard either one of you say is that Warren is just not capable of doing anything like this.
I never saw him become angry or abusive.
Okay.
Now, Warren was a drinker, and he was a heavy drinker. And when he got drunk, he was not a pretty drunk.
Okay.
That caused him to be less likable.
Well, and it was interesting too, because to have friends and people who aren't super close to you say, yeah, you could be a mean drunk. To me, that means a lot because we all have different personalities behind closed doors, right? I mean, nobody's really ever seen you get as mean or say really low things, probably like your spouse or your significant other. That's when you can get pretty evil. So, you know, for somebody who's not that person in your life to say you can get pretty mean, it made me wonder, if he's like that around other people, what's he like behind closed doors when he's that drunk?
So one of the things that was really odd about this case was that the cause of death had originally been ruled a suicide, and then a year later they changed it to murder. Either one of you, how unusual is that, and is that a little bit suspicious?
Sometimes they're just still investigating. I feel like it's reckless. I mean, most of the time the coroner should make a, you know, they can't determine, right? And then the case remains open and there's an investigation. So I believe it's pretty reckless to say suicide and then later homicide without any other physical evidence or eyewitness or something like that, just because you can declare, you can say it's undetermined in the beginning and then continue the investigation.
It was actually pretty strange to me without any other information. You know, I've got cases on my desk right now that are listed as undetermined, and these cases have gone on for 7 or 8 years without any other information that comes along to change the classification of that that report. And I've rarely seen it happen. So yes, strange to me. Yes, it was.
And our independent medical examiner also said that he would have ruled it a suicide.
Yeah.
So, Chris, I had a question for you that came up when we were talking to that medical examiner. And he was making a really big deal about how there were no defensive wounds on the victim.
Right.
But I'm wondering, in your experience, when it's a domestic violence type of thing, there's a lot of drinking involved, it's a gun. From my perspective, right, just looking at it as a layman, it didn't seem like there would have to be defensive wounds, right? I mean, if she's arguing with someone that she lives with and is married to and trusts, the element of surprise, couldn't that have explained why there were no defensive wounds, or am I looking at it the wrong way?
No, you're exactly right, Rob. In a case like that, I wouldn't expect to see any defensive wounds, because number one, he's done this before. He's pulled guns out on her before, and we don't know how many times that went unreported and things of that nature, but he's pulled a gun out on her before. We know that for a fact. And he's also fired a gun at her before. So why wouldn't we think on a night that he's intoxicated that they got into a squabble or an argument? Because I'm sure that argument carried over from the club back to their bedroom. A night he's extremely intoxicated. He pulls out a gun, sticks it to her chest, and she thinks, you know, hey, he's not going to do anything. He's done this several times before. I'm used to it. And then bam.
Or, I mean, they both come home drunk. She's already in her nightgown in bed. Who's to say she's not passed out and asleep? And then he comes in and decides to do it.
Yeah, that's a weird thing with me. So what's a lot of times when we talk to experts, it seems as though there's certain assumptions that they make. And this is just an example of that. And sometimes I wonder, like, are those assumptions getting in the way, right, of the final determinations? Like, do we have to assume that there would be defensive wounds? Like you said, maybe she was asleep, or maybe she'd just been there before. And it seems like that happens a lot. Is that something, Chris, that you would deal with when you were investigating a homicide and talking to experts?
Yeah. So I think, you know, look, I respect Dr. Crowns. I respect his opinion. And he said a few things also that led me to believe that, you know, he was kind of unsure about this. But with the evidence that they had at the preliminary investigation, and it was deemed a suicide at that time, you know, he made his determination from there. And there was no other information that was brought into the medical examiner's office that should make them change that first classification. So I think that that's what he based his decision or his findings from. But, you know, I just, I mean, I,
Lack of defensive wounds is always an issue. I mean, I feel like it always comes into play in a homicide, right? I mean, that's a big deal. You're going to look at it, and if there are none, then you're going to wonder, was there a confrontation? But I don't believe in this situation where people are in their own home, there needed to be a confrontation. This is a woman this is her husband. He's a mean drunk. She's seen him act that way before. Like Chris said, he shot at her once before. He likes to be intimidating. He probably likes to say really awful things to her. And she was just like, it's another one of those nights. I'm going to go to bed. Mm-hmm. And she just never woke up. I mean, that's personally what I believe happened.
So another big piece of circumstantial evidence in this case was the 911 call. And Fatima, you went to an expert who, just by way of background, we never could get into the show, was an original member of the band Sha-Na-Na. Very random little
Greece,
fact.
Greece, right?
He said he performed at Woodstock before Jimi Hendrix. So. Anyway, so we played the 911 call. Former Fatima, you were playing clips of it. And I want to play one little clip of that 911 call because early in the call, he sounds very drunk. But then in the clip I'm about to play, he sounds a lot more sober. And that was used against him. And Fatima, I'm curious about your thoughts about that.
Wait, my wife just shot herself. Get over here now.
We're on our way, sir.
All right, get an ambulance and...
Okay, we're on our way.
I don't know what, I guess what I was looking for is that, you know, he wasn't trying to fake cry or, you know, he's just telling them get here now, but it doesn't make a difference whether he shot her or she shot herself. His emotion is just drunk. That's his emotion. And I didn't feel like he really did sober up at any point in there. I think maybe what had happened was his adrenaline as he, you know, realized what had happened. And while he's on the phone, I think, you know, maybe he just kind of figured it, okay, I need to enunciate better. But the call for me was kind of a wash. I don't know how someone's going to behave in that situation. Like I said, I know for me, maybe I'd be a little more emotional, but when you're dealing with someone who's inebriated, I don't know if he's even capable of really trying to manipulate or anything like that. And the reason I say that too is because, you know, he thinks she's breathing.
For background on this, about 7.5 minutes into the call, the operator specifically asks Warren, is she still breathing? And he says, yes, very clearly. And we know from the medical examiner's report that she was definitely dead about a minute in. And so Chris, talk about your thought process, because I think for you, that was very indicative of guilt. The fact that a trained police officer would say that when she was clearly dead.
Yeah, it very well could have been him trying to boast of the fact that he knew he shot his wife and that play the role of being a caring and the person that didn't do this or not, he's not responsible for this. So he wants it on tape that she's still breathing.
Well, and not just that, but I mean, it's all his efforts to save her, right? I'm trying to save her. I'm, doing mouth to mouth and I'm pushing and this is how I got blood on me. But if, mm-hmm. you know, if you already know somebody's deceased, you probably wouldn't be able to help them. So you'd just be sitting there and begging for the ambulance to hurry. But, you know, he needs maybe a reason to have blood all over him.
Just to explain, to explain that physical evidence also. Yeah, I agree with that.
Fatima, I think that one of the most powerful parts of this investigation was when you spoke to Holly. She was a former police officer who had worked with Warren and actually became pretty good friends with Bonnie, the victim. In this clip I'm going to play, you asked her what her first reaction was when she found out that Bonnie had died.
Just wanted to hit my fist on the counter and go, I knew it. I knew this was going to happen.
You knew and you couldn't do anything. Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand it. I don't understand how someone that kind and lovable can stay in that type of situation. I cannot relate to that. I don't understand that.
Do you think it's possible Bonnie committed suicide?
No.
And you believe that Warren was capable of taking Bonnie's life?
Yes, intoxicated. In my mind, there is no doubt. I think he did it. I thought so then, and today sitting before you, I think he did it. That was my friend, and I loved her. and I enjoyed her company, and she had a bright, amazing career in front of her. And you just stole everything from her. You had no right to do that.
You know, after diving into this case, the suicide, especially, you know, I'm sure for Chris, after he spoke with the expert, the suicide angle was a major possibility. That's the first.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Thing written on, you know, the death certificate. You gotta look into that. And if this person had any kind of issues in her past of depression or isolation or anything like that, then, you know, it's a major possibility. But as we started to learn more about Bonnie, she was a very likable person. She was a very ambitious person. She was smart. She had a lot of friends. She loved being around other people. You just didn't get that sense of this kind of desperate, lonely person who would do this, as if she, you know, not to say that people who do that don't have anything going for them, but there were just no other signs. But once I learned more about his personality, the kind of drunk that he is, and knowing that he was drunk that night, he seemed much more capable of killing Bonnie than Bonnie seemed of committing suicide. So for me, that was, and also Holly was a friend of Warren's to begin with. And, you know, we can't put everything into the show, but backstory was she actually didn't really want to hang out with him to begin with because, you know, he just had a bad reputation in the police department. He was a drunk. He was angry. And so she avoided him. He invited her and her husband out to dinner many times and she kept saying no. Finally, he said, you know, I want you to meet my wife. And she said she gave it a shot one night and she just fell in love with Bonnie. She really enjoyed being with Bonnie. And so the friendship bloomed and she spent a lot of time with them as a couple.
So Chris, when you went to the prison and you got to interview Warren one-on-one, what did you see? Obviously, you were seeing the Warren that was trying to make the best possible impression on you, but were you able to see anything beyond that during your conversation with him?
He's a talker. He's the type of person that will, you know, he's a charmer, and he's had the many years he's had in prison to prepare himself for the interview or prepare himself to give his side of what happened or his accounts of what happened. So, if you put the person that I spoke with in prison up against the drunk Warren, as we call him on the episode, you know, they were two completely different persons. Was there any signs of just absolute rage that came out during our interview? No, there wasn't.
Well, let me play a clip. I wouldn't say rage, but you got him at a certain point to admit to what happened when he fired that shot over his wife's head, and you guys mixed it up a little bit. So I want to play this clip and have you react to it.
I had gone back. She'd already gone to sleep. And I'd gone back into the bedroom and said, hey, and I was wanting to tell her what was on TV. And so she rolls over and she grabs a pillow and she pulls it over her head. She says, I'm ignoring Warren. I'm ignoring Warren. All right. So that gun is between the box springs and the mattress.
Okay.
And I pulled it out and I held it up against the wall and I said, well, ignore this. And I fired it.
What made you do that?
Just a stupid ass prank.
A prank?
Stupid. Totally asinine. I understand.
That way oversteps the boundaries of asinine.
Yeah, so that, and that's where I was about to go. So when he talked about the disagreements and arguments or confrontations that he had that involved Bonnie, you know, they just really go way out of hand really, really quick. So that kind of lets me know that, yeah, the things that these folks said about him, the way that he's been portrayed throughout this entire investigation, that is absolutely true. You know, he did fly off the handle. He was an abusive husband because, you know, you don't pull a weapon out on your wife at any point unless you are very extremely controlling. And that's just indicative of what abusers do. They start off small, which I'm sure that was not the only incident of violence that she witnessed at the hands of Warren. You know, so and it gets progressively worse. Every case that I've worked that involved abuse, that's how it starts off. It started off small and it gets progressively worse. And I saw that in him during that interview. And he actually he admitted to it. So
after but he
called it a prank.
It just goes
that's
to
minimizing
show.
It, you know, and that's absolutely. That's exactly what abusers do. They minimize
somebody
their
pulling
actions.
A gun on you. I mean, that is terrifying. Mm-hmm. He knew that by pointing that gun at her, he probably thought it was funny. He probably thought it was funny how he tormented that woman day in and day out. Around friends, in front of other people, humiliating her, embarrassing her, and then at home terrifying her, and mm-hmm. you call it a prank? Mm-hmm. Not just that, he also minimized his drinking. Oh, I was happy-go-lucky drunk. Bull. Holly said that there were many people, including her and her husband, that told him, we will no longer go to dinner with you. We will no longer hang out with you if you are drinking. And he laughed. He said, well, why? I don't have a problem. And she said, oh, you do. And it's bad. And the way you humiliate Bonnie in front of us, the way you treat her. So he minimized that too. Mm-hmm.
Even with us thinking about it now and talking about it now, you know, it just brings up so many different emotions with me because, you know, this woman was probably tormented throughout their entire marriage. And now she's gone. After she forgave him for what he did with pulling the weapon out, you know, it's unimaginable what she went through throughout that marriage that she didn't report, that she didn't talk to anyone about.
Well, Warren is lucky that he had an amazing friend in Jeff Dunn who told us he was the king of second chances. And Jeff is actually here. Jeff.
Yes, sir.
Hey, Jeff. How you doing,
Chris?
Man? How you doing?
I'm doing great.
How you holding?
Good. How are y'all?
Doing well. You still enjoying retirement?
Oh, yes, sir. Very much.
So, Jeff, we wanted to check in. And, you know, it's been 7 or 8 months since we actually sat across from you and Chris and Fatima had presented the results of the investigation. Has anything shifted with you and has anything shifted with Warren since that time?
Well, it's funny that you should mention that. Yes and no. I'll go with the yes part first. Communication between Warren and me has decreased significantly. I think the last communication we had was probably right before Christmas. And I wrote him a long email and just went over the things that I remembered about our final conversation with you guys, and the conclusion that you had come to, and the process involved in all that. And I just shared with Warren, you know, some of my frustrations and some of my thoughts about what the future was going to look like, what it may look like, what it may hold for him, and just try and encourage him and prepare and get him to prepare for you know, what that future might be. And I sent that to him, and I have not heard back from him. So I don't, you know, as far as since Christmas time, I have no idea what's going on with him.
What was it exactly, Jeff, that you told him to prepare for?
Well, I told him that barring any miraculous appearance of new evidence, that it didn't appear that he was going to be able to get a new trial on that. And he may be able to get to paroled, but he was going to have to reenter society with the stigma of being a felon, of being a murderer, a person who very possibly has murdered his wife, and the stigma of being a wife abuser. I told him that's, you know, it's an awfully deep hole to overcome, but it's not impossible. It's not insurmountable. And I offered anything that I could do, including, you know, a place to stay. He needed one to regather his thoughts and to figure out what his next moves were going to be, knowing that he was going to be pretty severely limited in what he was going to be able to do and how he was going to be able to live in the future. It wasn't going to look anything like he had experienced in the past, other than, you know, being in prison. It was going to be better than that, but I don't know. It looked kind of bleak to me, but there was a thread of hope that I wanted to share with him.
Well, and you offered your help later on, and he didn't respond to that?
No.
You know, we were talking earlier in this podcast about how when we had tried to find the people closest to Warren to best represent him for this investigation, really it was you and then Bob, who he didn't really know all that well to begin with. Unfortunately, is this kind of part of Warren's character that he drives those closest to him away?
Yeah, you know, Warren is a different kind of character. He does have, you know, like I said, when he was sober, he was a likable guy, not necessarily arrogant, but outgoing, friendly, likable guy. But once he had some drinks in him, and then he became arrogant and really isolated himself. I think people that saw him as a drinker, as a drunk, didn't like them, and they distanced themselves from him, and probably for good reason too.
And Jeff, you're a man of faith, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Have you ever given Warren the opportunity in the role that you always had in the police department to kind of ask for forgiveness, go to God and say, you know, if you did this, ask for forgiveness and move on in life?
You know, when this all happened, I was over at his house a lot, probably 2, maybe 3 times a week. And we sat on the couch and we talked a lot about what had happened, what was going to happen. He talked a lot about their relationship from his perspective, and I just, you know, I just, I just, I, we talked about spiritual things. And he certainly, I certainly gave him the opportunity to get things right. And I think, in a sense, he did, as far as his relationship with Bonnie. He had said some things and done some things to her that he regretted, that he was repentant for, but was kind of at a loss, because as he was repentant, she was not there anymore to give him that release of forgiveness. And I tried to tell him, you know, that that even though she wasn't there, the fact that, you know, that that he recognized the things that he had done were inappropriate, were wrong, to recognize those, to call them what they were, to seek forgiveness, was all he could do, and that he had to have enough faith to believe that the God that we serve is a God big enough to accept that as it is and forgive him, and to begin to live his life with that forgiveness.
Well, I mean, you know, and it's obvious that he was one person in front of you, but in front of the other people that we spoke about, spoke to about him, he was somebody completely different. You know, there are certain people in your life that you try to maintain, you put on the best face for. You know, I have people in my life that I try to put the best face on for. And you know, I don't know Warren, I don't know y'all's relationship, but I mean, from everything that you've said and everything that Warren said, I think that you are that person in his life that he's always tried to put his best face on for.
What do you want me to say, Chris? Do you want me to say, I think he's a murderer? I think he killed his wife?
Absolutely. I wouldn't do you like that. I mean,
I think what we're looking for perhaps is more of an acknowledgement that perhaps you didn't know Warren the way a lot of other people did, that he put his best, you know, face forward with you, especially being, you know, the man of God that you are, and probably almost like a mentor, father figure for him, someone who he can go to, confide in. You know, I think what we're saying is, based on what other people close to him have said, can you at least admit that you may not have known Warren as well as you thought?
Yeah, I can say that. I guess what I'm looking for is something definitive that would make me say, yeah, beyond a reasonable doubt, I believe that Warren killed her. And I haven't seen that evidence yet. So am I naive enough to say, oh no, there's no way Warren could have done that? No, I'm not going to say that. Is Warren capable of hurting her? Well, yes, certainly he is. Did he hurt her? I don't know.
I can tell you this: if Bonnie took her own life, the way that I see that happening was, you know, when they were coming home drunk, you know, and she said she was done with him, I'm not going to do this anymore. Perhaps he said, yeah, try it. I'll kill you because he's drunk. And maybe that's when she realizes, you know what? I'm not going to get out of this alive. I'm not going to get away from this man. And maybe that's what caused her to pull the trigger. That is the only other possibility we're looking at, right? But in both possibilities, we know that he's left her in a situation where she has no way out.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Jeff, thank you so much for calling in and for updating us. And maybe he doesn't realize it right now, but I think Warren's very lucky to have you in his corner.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, I appreciate you following up, and I appreciate you guys. I appreciate what you do. And I hope you're able to help a lot of people that really need the help, that feel helpless. And you guys give them at least an opportunity to get their story out there. I always want to see justice done right. you know, a person that's in jail that doesn't need to be in jail needs to be free. And a person that needs to be in jail needs to stay in jail. And I think you guys are a part of making all that happen. Thank you.
Jeff, thank you, man. You take care of yourself, okay?
And thank you, Jeff, all right, Chris, for everything you do, too. You know, you are an awesome friend.
All right, that does it for this episode of the Reasonable Doubt podcast. Hopefully we have whet your appetite and you are going to start watching the show on ID Tuesday nights, 10 o'clock. We're going to be back next week with a brand new case. My name is Rob Rosen. I am the executive producer and creator of Reasonable Doubt.
I'm Fatima Silva, criminal defense attorney and co-host of Reasonable Doubt.
And I'm Detective Chris Anderson. I'm a former homicide investigator and I'm the co-host of Reasonable Doubt.
All right. Stay 6 feet away from everyone. Wash your hands. Stay safe. And we will be back next week.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.